Welcome to Spectrum Today, Democracy Now! And more, WPFW's grassroots news from around the world. It's Thursday, October 21st. I'm Pete Tucker, filling in for Askia Muhammad. Now to today's local headlines. Tuesday, the D.C. Council unanimously passed legislation that will require that juveniles have their criminal records released to the public if they are convicted of a violent crime. If Mayor Adrian Fenty signs the legislation, it may make it harder for young people convicted of an offense to go to college or get a job. Harold Hunter works with young people as a substitute teacher with DCPS and as a volunteer with Cease Fire, Don't Smoke the Brothers and Sisters. Hunter expressed concern regarding the council's recent legislation and called on Mayor Fenty not to sign the bill in its current form.
I think this legislation is unjust, and I understand that it was a unanimous decision by the city council, but I hope and pray that the language be reconstructed, because the way that the language is now is that if you have a juvenile record, everyone in D.C. will be voided. The youth will not have an understanding of growing and understanding the opportunity to be a lifelong citizen. And I am very causative of the fact that if you can have a juvie life and that you can be charged as a minor, I think that it should be sealed at some sentiment. For example, if you're a minor and if you do a misdemeanor, it should be stayed as a misdemeanor. But if you commit a felony, I think that the language should stipulate that. If you get a permanent record, you are permanently scarred for life. And I hope and pray that Mayor Fenty does not sign this bill into law. And if he should, it should be some type of language that should be changed in the bill. I'm ready for all of the killing to stop. I enjoy working with a lot of at-risk groups, one of which is Cease Fire, Don't Smoke the Brothers and Sisters. Al-Malik Farrakhan is the executive director. And there are many other at-risk groups in the city. I think they should stand up now, and this is their time to speak vehemently about the youth, because we have to get involved with saving the youth's life.
The Washington Post recently published a manifesto on school reform, which claimed that the difficulty in removing incompetent teachers has, quote, left our school districts impotent and, worse, has robbed millions of children of a real future, end quote. The manifesto was signed by 16 big city school district chiefs, including New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein, outgoing D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, Baltimore Public Schools Chief Executive Andres Alfonso, Superintendent of Prince George's County Schools William Height, among others. Also signing the manifesto was Philadelphia Public Schools Superintendent Arlene Ackerman, who served as D.C. Superintendent of Schools from 1998 to 2000. However, after reading the manifesto, which Ackerman said is different than what she had seen, she withdrew her support. In a strongly worded letter published online at the Washington Post, Ackerman said, quote, I have written this letter after discovering that the original document to which I affixed my name was not what later appeared in print, nor did it fully encompass my core principles. Unfortunately, the views of this career urban educator are not likely to make the big screen because the facts are too complex and there is no kryptonite. The truth is, our public schools have been asked not only to educate children, but also to solve many of the ills that the larger society either cannot or will not fix. I am speaking of issues directly related to poverty, like hunger, violence, homelessness, and unchecked childhood diseases. In spite of these challenges, there are thousands of dedicated and committed educators who are working hard to make access to a quality education for all children who attend public schools a reality, end quote. Also on the education front, Teaching for Change has published an article entitled First-Hand View of the D.C. School Reform Debate in D.C. It reads, quote, absent from the discussion on school reform are the voices of many DCPS students, parents, and teachers. The story of one school where we have worked on parent organizing, Bruce Monroe Elementary School, is among the examples of why D.C. voters rejected the substance of the reforms, end quote. Deborah Menkart is executive director of Teaching for Change and authored the article.
We posted a short story on our website about the recent election, and are concerned that the voters' decision to was reflected as one of a concern about tone rather than substance with changes, reform in the school system. And we, our own experience is that there's been great concerns about the substance, particularly with a school that we've worked very closely with for many years, that's Bruce Monroe Elementary School, where the parents had organized so successfully that the school was fully enrolled, had a new bilingual program, had a new library, and had met AYP, and yet ended up in 2008 being listed as one of the schools slated for closure, even though only schools that were either under-enrolled or had not met AYP were supposed to be closed. And after the parents fought and organized, along with some of the staff, for a year, it was taken off the closure list, but the school was still forced to consolidate with another school. Students were relocated. And so in this whole debate where we're talking about tone, this was not an issue of tone. This was an issue of substance of the education of over 350 children and their future.
The Washington Area Women's Foundation has released a report entitled 2010, Portrait of Women and Girls in the Washington Metropolitan Area. The report culminates a year-long research partnership among Washington Area Women's Foundation, Urban Institute, Institute for Women's Policy Research, Trinity Washington University, and the Girl Scout Council of the nation's capital. The report finds that, in our region, 1 in 5 women-headed households with children is poor and likely to have housing that is unaffordable. The report also finds that the cost of center-based infant care is 52% of the median income of a single mother with young children. Nikki Gorin is president and CEO of the Washington Area Women's Foundation.
The 2010 portrait of women and girls in the Washington metropolitan area provides a clear and current picture of the status of women and girls in the D.C. metro region, and it will serve as a critical tool for policymakers, community-based organizations, and funders for years to come. And some of the most startling findings in Portrait Project 2010 were how wide the gap is between upper-income and lower-income women in our region. On the one hand, we have some of the wealthiest, most highly educated women in the country living in the D.C. metro area, and at the same time, within blocks of these women, we have more than 177,000 women and girls living in poverty. The report also shows that the cost of center-based infant care is 52% of the median income of a single mother. And we also found that about two-thirds of single women-headed families live in unaffordable housing, which means they're spending more than 30% of their income on housing. So to get an idea of what these statistics really mean, we broke it down with real numbers. If you take a woman raising children on her own in the district, she has a median annual income of $29,900 or $2,492 a month. If she spends half of that on child care and another $1,011 on rent, she's left with about $300 a month or $10 a day for everything else. She's trying to clothe, feed, and transport herself and her children on just $300 a month. So Portrait Project 2010 will guide the Women's Foundation's future grant making. We'll be presenting the findings to organizations and foundations, government officials throughout the community. We've signed on to convene 3 listening sessions for the White House Council on Women and Girls about the findings of the report. And it's really critically important to invest in women and girls if we want to improve our region as a whole. When a woman is economically secure, so is her family, her neighborhood, and her city. And finally, the report shows that only about 7% of national foundation dollars go to projects aimed at benefiting women and girls. We women and girls make up half of the community, and we really need to increase the support to organizations serving them.
The Prince George's County Council is considering a 2% pay raise for non-unionized county employees. The council is also considering a pay raise for themselves and the county executive. Prince George's County Council members earn more than $96,000 a year for their part-time positions, and the county executive earns more than $174,000 a year. Like Prince George's County Council members, D.C. Council members also define their job as part-time, which allows them to earn outside income. Possibly the two most egregious examples of outside salaries for D.C. Council members are at-large Council Member David Catania and Ward 2 Council Member Jack Evans. In addition to his council salary of more than $125,000 a year, Mr. Catania earns $120,000 a year from Open Band LLC, according to Office of Campaign Finance reports. Open Band LLC is a subsidiary of MC Dean, a company which, according to the Washington Post, quote, holds the contract to maintain and repair city traffic signals, one of the most lucrative contracts in city government. Last year's contract was worth $9.3 million to the company. Since 1999, according to city billing records, MC Dean has done more than $130 million in business with the district, end quote. In addition to his council salary, Ward 2 Councilmember Jack Evans earns $240,000 a year from the law firm Patton Boggs. It is unclear what he does for this money. The Washington Business Journal reports that Councilmember Evans has withdrawn a bill that would have provided $100,000 in tax breaks to allow Shiloh Baptist Church to carry out renovations on its property on 9th Street Northwest. Evans said, quote, the purpose of the legislation is to explore the idea of having monies owed by Shiloh put into escrow and used to renovate the properties rather than paying the money to the district government, end quote. While Evans has withdrawn this legislation, which would have provided Shiloh with $100,000 in tax breaks in order to make renovations, he continues to push forward with $61 million in tax breaks for an Adams Morgan Hotel, which will displace WPFW, as well as $272 million in public subsidies for the Convention Center Hotel to be owned by Marriott. Mr. Evans has repeatedly refused to say whether Marriott is a client of Patton Boggs. D.C. Council Chairman and presumptive Mayor-elect Vincent Gray continues his listening tour this evening with a Ward 8 Town Hall meeting at Matthews Memorial Baptist Church, scheduled to start at 7 p.m. Tuesday evening, hundreds of people gathered at Carlos Rosario Public Charter High School for Gray's Ward 1 Town Hall. Issues discussed included the closure of Bruce Monroe Elementary School, the removal of Patrick Pope as principal of Hardy Middle School, bullying of students, particularly gay, lesbian, and transgender students, and of course, the need for jobs for district residents. Here's some of what Vincent Gray had to say to the overflow crowd at Carlos Rosario Tuesday evening. The audio is not great, so listen carefully.
22,000 construction jobs that will be created on the campus to develop Homeland Security. And frankly, if we don't take full advantage of that, we all ought to be on the next bus out of town, because that will be an opportunity, the likes of which we have never seen in this city before. We have first source agreements. You know, anybody know what first source is? Well, it isn't effectively implemented, in my opinion. We need more teeth in it. We need to say to people, if you get a contract from the District of Columbia, you are required, 51% of your new hires have to be people who live in the District of Columbia. And we should say to people, if you don't comply with that, that's okay. That's okay. Just two things. One, you will never get another contract with the District of Columbia. And the one way you need to comply with the law, you just had that taken away from you. So get out of town. I'm gonna open up for questions shortly. But you know, I want to work also to try to get more of our first responders in the city. Only 19% of our police officers actually live in the District of Columbia. We ought to be able to begin to develop, as we develop new communities and other projects, we ought to be able to develop workforce housing that creates incentives for our first responders to live in the District of Columbia. And why, as a part of career and technical education, can't we put elements of first responder programs in our high schools so that our 11th and 12th graders get exposed to being a police officer or being a firefighter and then going to the academies after that? And yes, the reality is that the consequences of this recession have hit and hit hard in the District of Columbia. We have cut budgets for the last 2 years. We're facing another $175 million shortfall, and frankly, it's going to get even worse than that. And we're going to have to come back to you all with some proposals, and I hope people will participate in helping us make the right decisions. Now, I haven't met anybody yet who didn't say, We understand, Mr. Gray. Get that budget balanced. But by the way, don't cut that chair right there. Don't cut that light out right there. Don't cut that pole off right there. Don't cut this speaker system off. And by the time you listen to all of it, you know what's left to cut? Nothing. Nothing. So I need you to not only agree with me in principle that we got to have a balanced budget, but we need the people of this city to recognize that unless we can generate a lot more money than we're generating now, the only way we're going to balance this budget is by making some reductions. I don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. But we don't want to have a control board back in the District of Columbia either, do we? Now, I don't know what's going to happen at these elections nationally. It's not potentially a pretty picture, is it, Jim? We may have, if there are any Republicans in here, I would apologize, but I'm not. If you want to become a Democrat, see me right after this meeting, and I'll help you get signed up. But the specter of the Republicans taking control of the House of Representatives is a harrowing one for us in the city. Because it means that we can start to have the clock roll back on so many advancements that we've made. We have been blessed to have a gentleman have oversight for us in the Congress by the name of Jose Serrano. He is an outstanding congressman for the Bronx. We had him down to the Congress, down to the council, excuse me, down to the county just recently. And one of the things he said, I am the only person in the Congress of the United States who wants to give up power. And he said, the power I want to give up is the power over the District of Columbia, because every district resident ought to be able to make the decision for themselves, just like you can do in the rest of this country. Now, I don't know what the future holds. I hope that on November 2nd, we see the Democrats stay in place in both the House and the Senate. But if it changes, I think we're going to have somebody who tries to roll the clock back. And frankly, we have a choice. We can just sit here and take it and talk about it, you know, come together, talk about it, and wring our hands and, you know, say, isn't that awful, and I'm sorry, and all that kind of stuff. Or we can stand up and fight. I've been to a lot of statehood rallies, you all, where there's some very dedicated people among the 50 who show up for the rally, among the 75 who show up for the rally, and on a good day, 100. You know how much change is going to take place with that kind of turnout to fight for statehood? Nothing. It's not going to happen. So even if we don't get a change in the leadership of the House of Representatives, we need to be in a position to be able to stand up and make the case that we not only want a vote in Congress, we want two senators, we want legislative autonomy, we want budget autonomy, and we want to be able to control our destiny just like everybody else. Why should we pay our membership dues and never get a membership card? It's time for that to be over with. We paid $3.6 billion in taxes last year to the federal government. And it's time for us to stand up and fight for ourselves. People ask me, are you willing to go up there and meet? Yeah, of course I'm willing to go up there and meet. But what good is a meeting going to do if I look over my right shoulder or my left shoulder and see nobody back there? I can tell you how the meeting will go. It'll be, how are you, Mr. Gray? We're glad you're up here today. How's it going in the District of Columbia? Really? Well, let us know. You keep us posted on how it's going, okay? And you know what that will amount to? Nothing. And yes, people have asked me if I'm willing to go to jail. I certainly am. I've been a rabble-rouser on many fronts, not the least of which fighting for the rights of people with disabilities. And you know what? If they handcuff me and take me off by myself, Jim, they can find a jail cell for me. But you know what? They won't find a jail cell for 1,000 people if I have 999 people with me. So which will it be? It's up to you. It's up to every one of us. Which will it be? Do we stand around and wring our hands and say, isn't this awful? Whoa, I'm so sorry. Or do we stand up and fight for ourselves? Is it going to happen overnight? No, it's not going to happen overnight. But it is never going to happen unless the people of the District of Columbia stand up for ourselves. This country was founded on resistance to taxation without representation. Yet the hypocrisy of it all is that we stand right here in the nation's capital and have taxation without representation every day. And it's time for it to end, ladies and gentlemen. I'm prepared to wait. These folks behind me can see it. All these seats are filled. We got people across the back of the room. We got seats up here, and we have an overflow room too, right, Jim? This is the kind of stuff that makes a statement. This is not lost on anybody. And this is not about me, it's about our city. When we say that 700, 800, 1,000 people are coming out in every ward to talk about the future of our city, that makes a powerful statement. Don't let this be the last time you do this. Make it the first time for the future of the District of Columbia. And I promise you, if we stick together, if we fight together, you will see change in the District of Columbia. And we will become I didn't intend to get all revved up in here tonight, but that's all right.
Presumptive Mayor-elect Vincent Gray then took questions. The first one was asked by former Ward 1 council member Frank Smith.
So we are going to be taking questions from the stage area. Roxanna, there's Roxanna. She'll be taking questions from the stage area. Denise is over here. She'll be taking questions from that side. I will be covering this side and also the people in the overflow room upstairs.
There are people in the lobby, too. Yeah, let's get a microphone out of the lobby.
Those of you in the lobby.
Let the voices be heard.
I'm collecting questions from those upstairs, and those of you in the lobby, if you want to write down a question, I'll be happy to ask it for you. Chairman Gray, we do have a section in front for hearing impaired. We are also translating in two languages tonight, so if anyone needs a headset for translation in Spanish or in part, please let us know. In part.
All right, are we ready?
Yes.
All right, we got Roxanna over here. Roxanna has a microphone. All right, I'll let you lead the process of selecting people and throwing it to others with the mics and whatnot, and we'll try to do the best we can to answer questions.
Okay, we'll start with Roxanne.
Anything that's a hard question, I'm going to let Jim Graham take it. Frank?
Good evening, all. My first question is the homeless and housing situation that we have here in the city. What is your plan about sort of abating the housing shortage here in the District of Columbia?
Well, as you well know, Frank, as somebody who served on the Housing Authority Board, that's a very difficult question. I want to commend Mayor Finty for the work that he's done on the Housing First program, getting people off the streets into housing. We need to do more about making sure that the people who are there get services. We really have three groups of people who are homeless in the city. We have singles who are typically on the streets. We have families, and we have mounting numbers of families in the city. I think this time last year we had about 35 or 40 families who were homeless. We're now approaching 200 families who are homeless, many of whom are in very difficult conditions at DC General Hospital. And then we have, that's right, we have veterans who are among the singles, that's exactly right. And we also have homeless youth. And that's what I did when I worked for Covenant House. That's what Latin American Youth Center does. I see Lori Kaplan here tonight. That's what Sasha Bruce does. That's what Covenant House does. And that oftentimes is a different, manifests itself in different ways. And that is, a lot of these young people are often homeless for a long time. They move from one place to the other, one person's house to the other, until they wind up on the streets. And you have outreach like Latin American Youth Center, Sasha Bruce, and Covenant House, getting them off the street. We are working, Frank, to try to get some of these families into apartments. But it's going to take the cooperation also of the people in the city. We can't say that we need to find homes for families and then just say, I'm sorry, but not in my neighborhood. We've got to be able to get past that. We've got to be able to say that everybody can have a decent place to live. And I don't say that lightly, because I've heard it. I've heard it not just yesterday, but I've heard it for a long time in the city, that, yeah, Greg, we got to get a place for these people to live over there. All right, every neighborhood should be accessible to a family who needs a place to live. All right. That's what a compassionate city is about. We have a waiting list of what, Frank, about 26,000 people in the District of Columbia. It is overwhelming. And we have a lot of tools that are put in place. I want to commend Ward 1 Councilmember Jim Graham for the outstanding work he's done on rent control in the District of Columbia to try to keep We have new communities which we're developing that's going to create in part housing that is affordable to those that, well, I don't want to get into all this AMI stuff, average median income and all of that, you know, people's eyes will be glazing over if I start that. But at certain levels, income levels that go all the way down, probably, what's 30%? That's probably about $30,000 for a family of four, right, Jim? Yeah. That are affordable at those levels. We have something new called inclusionary zoning that basically says, simply put, that if you want to build a building, we'll do, you know, we'll give you something if you give us something. If you will agree to build more units, if you will make more units affordable, we will let you build more units than you otherwise would be able to do. That's what inclusionary zoning is. We got a variety of tools in the District of Columbia, and I wish I could say we are winning the battle, but we're not winning the battle. There are a lot of people who still need housing in this city, and frankly, one of the challenges is not just to find housing, is to try to get people back to work so they can afford a place to live in the District of Columbia. Continue to work on both of those fronts, Frank, and we're especially going to work on the front of trying to get people the skill levels that they need to be able to take advantage of some of those jobs in this city. And we need to, especially, I want to underscore what's happening with the Department of Homeland Security. We've also got new development taking place at Walter Reed. As Walter Reed is converted, we got 62.5 acres there that will be opportunities for affordable housing. New retail, a host of opportunities, again, that should be available for the people of the District of Columbia. You know, it's great that people want to come here, but we need to take care of our own first, don't we? All right.
This evening, presumptive Mayor-elect Vincent Gray's listening tour continues with the Ward 8 Town Hall meeting at Matthews Memorial Baptist Church. It's scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. Those are some of the local headlines here on Spectrum today on WPF.